Good morning. Catching up with our panel this morning, and you'll get the chance to do that in just a moment. Welcome back to the Roundtable. If you're just joining us, welcome to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. It is the 10th of June, and things are flying here. It's 15 minutes past 9 o'clock. We welcome you, and we hope that you're in good spirits and ready to talk about the issues of the day. I know we are, and we welcome you to join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I've been asked to remind all of our listeners some of the basic letter writing rules because we fall into bad habits sometimes. This is what happens after school lets out for a while, and then you come back, you fall into bad habits over the summer, even though summer is just beginning. But here you go. Keep your letters short and to the point. Keep them on topic. So if we're talking about immigration, maybe don't bring up the Keystone Pipeline. That's an example. Now, you can bring up the Keystone Pipeline when we're talking about the Keystone Pipeline. But if you want your letter to be read, we'll do it when we're talking about that particular topic, if that makes sense. Don't include links. Don't include attachments. We can't open them. We don't open them. And they are not helpful. We don't want to open them. We don't want our computers to just blow up, because that's happened. And finally, the admonishment will stop. Don't use abbreviations. You may know what certain things mean, like PSE. I don't, or we don't. So don't use them, and just proofread your emails to make sure they have verbs and words and stuff, and that we can make sense.
I hate to be testy here, Joe.
Oh, don't.
But don't you think that there's a possibility that some people do it just to tick you off?
No, I honestly don't think that, because I send out many an email that makes, when I look at it second, and the second glance makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. And I know it's because I'm either writing quickly or, God forbid, I have dictated it into my iPhone.
Oh.
Do you find similar?
Yes, indeed, yes. I do.
Yeah. So that can, happen.
I have never dictated anything into my iPhone. You mean you can?
Yes, you can. Yes. And they make it really easy, actually. But the problem is that if you say, honey, I am going to the bank. Do you need anything else in town? It could come out as playing roulette with Stacy. Like, you don't know what's going to come out. You have to look at it before you press send.
Amazing. That's probably why I've never done it.
Anyway, we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Even though we told you all the reasons why they tick us off, please write to us. And most of you, all of you, do follow the rules, and we thank you for that, and we're glad for it. We got a ton of letters yesterday. It was hard keeping up. We got many, many, many letters. All right. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. Good to see you. How's everything?
Who invented coffee? Do we know?
I don't know who invented the beverage as we know it as coffee. I mean, I know the cocoa bean has been around probably forever.
But he's
going
to Google it right now.
Yeah. Why do you ask?
Well, because I love it so much.
Yeah. I was never a coffee guy. And then lately, the last several years, I've enjoyed picking up
I'm actually a decaffeinated person.
Goes back to the 9th century. Who invented coffee?
Marco Polo.
I think it was
Mr. Coffee.
Mr. Coffee. It was Mr. Coffee, played by Joe DiMaggio. But yeah, it goes back. Do you know how many billions of cups served annually at coffee?
No.
400 billion.
That's a lot.
400 million cups of coffee are consumed every day just in the United States. 107 million people in the country drink coffee every morning.
And there have been a gazillion studies as to whether it's healthy or not healthy, and it always comes out, we don't know.
We don't know.
And idiopathic.
And what do you put, right? And what you put into it. Judy Patrick is with us, Vice President for Editorial Development of the New York Press Association. Her first time joining us back in Studio Live, and we're thrilled to have you here. Good morning.
I am back around the round table. It's a glorious day, isn't it?
I saw you last week doing the media project, which was great. So then I'm glad you are here with us this morning.
And we just finished another media project, another great show.
Was anybody particularly obnoxious?
You know, Alan likes to be like the foil. and he likes to just be. At one point, I thought he was in favor
Peck's
of
bad boy. Is that your?
At one point, if you listen to the show, it sounds like he's in favor of the Justice Department seizing reporter records. He later clarifies his position, but for a few moments, I had a few scary moments thinking, "Ah, he's in favor of seizure of reporter information."
No, I'm in favor of an interesting program in which all views are expressed, even if they're not mine.
I was at the local brew pub on Sunday afternoon, speaking with my brother. My brother and I have a standing meeting at the brew pub where we catch up and find out what's going on in each other's lives, and we share a beer and talk things out. And your sister came in,
of course.
And we were talking, and I think I met your
son-in-law.
I met your son-in-law. Very nice young man.
Very nice.
Very, very nice young man. We had a very nice conversation. And your sister said, "Well, we have to go because the media project is on in a few minutes." And I said, "Wow, that is a devoted family right there. That's good."
Indeed.
There's one.
That's good. Terry Gibson is here. Lecturer and adjunct professor in communication for SUNY New Paltz and RPI, former New York State Senator. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I've got my coffee and I'm ready to go. I just hope I don't break any of the rules that you mentioned
before. No, you won't. You won't.
Because there were a lot of them.
You're off.
There was a whole lot of them.
Yeah. For panelists, don't have to worry about rules. And Malia Dumont is here, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College. Malia joins us via Opal Technology. Good morning, Malia. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. And I, on behalf of all the other tea drinkers out there like myself, I want to point out that 2.16 billion cups are consumed of tea per day around the world.
I do love tea, too. That's a good, very good point. Very, very good point to be made. Malia, I want to tell you, as I'm getting used to hosting a hybrid of in-studio and out-of-studio guests, and so if I've forgotten you, please just speak up. Every once in a while, I find myself going, I think there's someone else I should go to. And then I realize there's someone in my ear. So please, I will try not to, but feel free to interrupt at any time.
And we sure hope you'll be able to be here with us.
I can tell there's such a different dynamic that you can just, hear from people being there together in person. So I look forward to doing that.
Excellent. We are very happy you are here. Regardless of how you are here, and that is what counts. And I thank you very much for giving up time to be with us as we discuss the issues of the day. So let's talk about what has been happening, and we go to the president is in Europe. He has vowed to build alliances and democracy ahead of meetings with Group of Seven, NATO and European Union leaders, as well as Vladimir Putin of Russia. President Biden will announce plans to supply 500 million vaccine doses to other countries. President Biden began his first overseas trip by telling American troops in Britain that the future of the world depends on restoring the longstanding alliances with European countries that have been hardened in the fire of war and built by generations of America. Speaking to troops, he called his week-long diplomatic overture essential, saying that no nation acting alone can meet the world's challenges, but he also vowed to stand up to adversaries like China and Russia, pledging to tell President Putin of Russia what I want him to know. On the eve of meeting with European leaders rattled by Russia's aggressive movement of troops along Ukraine's borders, Mr. Biden pledged to, quote, respond in a robust and meaningful way to what he called, quote, harmful activities conducted by Mr. Putin. Mr. Biden also cast his trip in broader terms as an effort to rally the United States and its allies in an existential battle between democracy and autocracy. That from the New York Times. Alan, your thoughts on the president's first days in Europe?
Mario Cuomo once told me a story about, I said to him, you have all those people who are so grateful to you for all you have done for them. And he said, no, that's not true. And I said, well, look, think of all of the people you've appointed to positions. And he said, well, no, it doesn't work that way. What happens is you appoint 12 judges, you appoint 7 judges or 9 judges, and then you got 9 who may appreciate what you've done for them and about, 1,000 who hate you for not having appointed them. Point is that we're going to do some nice things. The country will do some nice things. But don't count on the fact that you're going to have forever, you know, thankfulness from the point of view of finally having gotten around to helping with the vaccines for the rest of the world or for much of the world. So, you know, I wouldn't hold my breath on that one. I think, of course, you know, cynicalness aside, it's great that that he's doing all of this, very contrasted with what the former president had to do with the rest of the world.
Judy Patrick.
So I enjoyed the return to normalcy that this is conveying to all of us, but like all the people in Europe, you've got to, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, well, yeah, Joe Biden is president now, but what's that crazy America going to do in 4 years? And I think that's going to be harder for us to resolve for the long term. I think that our European partners, our European allies have been justifiably rattled by the Trump administration, and now they've got Joe Biden's got some hard work to do in it. And I, in the back of everybody's mind has got to be, you know, what's going to happen in the next election.
What's coming down the pike.
Right.
Right. Terry Gibson.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think that Joe Biden is well positioned with his decades and decades of experience to go in and I think fairly quickly rebuild his own personal relationship with these individual countries in Europe. Both our friends and enemies, I suppose. My bigger concern is what's happening just in the country, our country in general. And I think the eyes of Europe are really not so much on the current president. They're on just the state of our democracy. And it's quite tenable position right now. And I think that it makes them nervous as it makes most of us nervous.
Malia.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's not surprising at all that Biden is starting off this trip by emphasizing the importance of alliances. So that's something that the Trump administration obviously got away from. It's long been a cornerstone of American strategy and foreign policy around the world. So it's nice to see that. I'm sure our allies in Europe are relieved and thankful for that. But I think everyone's still holding their breath a little bit to see how this Biden-Putin summit turns out, because U.S.-Russian relations are at their worst point that they've been in a very long time. And, you know, how are these two leaders going to interact with each other? What can we really expect to come out of the summit? That's a big question mark.
So with that said, how ultimately will we know, number one, and number two, what would be a success? Like walking out of there, if you're Joe Biden, what's a success?
What's a success from the Biden-Putin summit?
Yes, for Joe Biden and for this country.
So that's interesting. I think goes partly to what Terry just brought up. What's a success depending on who you are in the United States? Different audiences are going to rate this differently. So I think there are a lot of conservative politicians and people in the United States who just want to see Biden be really, really tough with Putin. I don't think that a lot of people are going to be satisfied by Biden's more diplomatic approach. It's hard to know.
No, we're okay. The phone has been answered. We're okay.
It was just my barber.
So it's you know what is the fact that the summit is taking place, there's somewhat of a victory in that on its own. I'm not sure if some kind of avenue comes out of it where there's the potential to have future conversations about potential collaboration on climate change and things like that. That'll be a nice signal. But there are a lot of places where there's no potential for a lot of understanding between the U.S. and Russia. And so how strongly is Biden going to come out in favor of things like really trying to hold Putin accountable for some of the cyber attacks that we've attributed to Russia and they have not acknowledged or accepted? Like that is something I'm interested in seeing what right. Biden will do, and different American audiences, I think, will react very differently to that.
We'll pause there. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Great panel this morning, Alan Chartok, Malia Dumont, Terry Gibson, and Judy Patrick. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. I already read the rules, so I won't do them again, but just remember them. Keep them in mind. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll have some messages and then go to news from the BBC. All right. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We have Alan Chartok, Malia DeMont, Terry Gibson, and Judy Patrick on the program, and we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. So one of the aspects of the story that we just mentioned, Alan touched on this, but I would like to focus a little bit more on it. Biden administration to buy 500 million Pfizer coronavirus vaccine doses to donate to the world. The Biden administration is getting the doses of Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine to donate to the world as the U.S. dramatically increases its efforts to help vaccinate more of the global population. The first 200 million doses will be distributed this year, with the subsequent 300 million shared in the first half of next year. The doses will be distributed by COVAX, the world... I thought you were going to say something else. The World Health Organization backed initiative to share doses around the world, and they will be targeted at low and middle income countries. Pfizer is selling the doses to the U.S. at a not-for-profit price. I do not know what that means in the world of pharmaceuticals, but my mind wanders. According to the people familiar with the deal, who spoke on the condition of anonymity to share details that were not yet public, President Biden is slated to announce the plan officially on this trip. And I think actually that announcement's already been made. So, I mean, that's good, right? But we but we also have the issue globally, and we have the issue nationally here of getting people vaccinated.
Yeah, well, we have a big problem. I'm astounded, and I don't know about the rest of you panelists, people, but I'm astounded by how political this still is. People who are going around wearing masks, and then they tell you, well, they were the first to tell you that Trump was our president. You know, it's a code. It's sort of, you know, stop bitching about Trump. And they wear masks, and they tell you they're not getting vaccinated. So that there is this sort of political thing to it, and it's insane. Because we know that lives are going to be saved and that people will die because they're stupid. I know that there'll be an awful lot of people who say, come on, Alan, that's not a good word to use for somebody who's misinformed. But if you're doing it to yourself and your spouse and your kids, it seems to me it's really outrageous. Anyway, we'll go back to your point about all of this. It does send a signal to the rest of the world that we care about you, and it's good. Whether they're going to be properly appreciative, I don't know.
I mean, you think of just the early days of COVID when the states were trying to get ventilators and PPE, and the government said, well, we're not in the business of being, I believe, a shipping clerk, is what the president said, President Trump. And then states were bidding each other, outbidding each other, and that was just in this country. So juxtapose that to now, where we're buying vaccines for other countries, low to middle class countries, as identified in this press release. Malia, your thoughts?
Well, China and to a lesser extent Russia have been way out ahead of us on this. You know, for months they've been providing their vaccines to countries around the world, particularly less developed countries. And a lot of experts, especially China watchers, have been saying, you know, China's winning the soft power war because they've been out in front on vaccine diplomacy. That may be not working out as well for them as it first appeared, because just 3 days ago, the government of Bahrain, which is one of the countries that has been, I believe, buying vaccines from China, because China's giving them for free to some countries, but selling them to others. The government of Bahrain just announced that the Chinese vaccine that they've been administering to their people is not as effective as they expected. So they're going to be offering different vaccines other than the Chinese one. So I think that'll raise some doubts in other places in the world that have been the recipient of Chinese vaccines. Of course, you know, we're talking about this as a political issue, but these are people's lives, and it's important to remember that. So I don't want to make it sound like this is just a big, great power play, but there is certainly an element of great power strategy here So,
Terry.
Hopefully.
No, go ahead.
Than the Chinese ones, and they'll be able to help even a wider swath of people.
Terry?
Yeah, communication experts will tell you that demonstrating goodwill is one of the very best ways to increase your credibility with an audience. And I think Joe Biden understands that, and his administration understands that, and I think that this will go a long way towards increasing the credibility of his administration. But it does go back to what we were saying before, in that this is an initiative that this president and his administration is taking within the powers that they have in the executive branch. If Donald Trump was in office, I'm not so sure we'd be doing this. Also, this did not come as a result of some grand compromise that the two political parties in our country made together. It's not coming from Congress. So does it increase the credibility of our country in the eyes of Europe, I think, is, or the world in general, I think, is a question that still is going to have to be
answered.
What
do you think?
Well, it doesn't hurt, but it is coming really at the direction of the top elected official in our country, which does speak volumes. I think we're going to have to do more as a country from within Congress, from within both political parties, to really get back to solidifying the credibility that we used to have before Trump managed to destroy it.
You know, I just want to say something very quickly. Years and years ago, we're talking years ago, I worked with a congressman as an intern, and he had me in charge of sending out, you know, the questionnaire, the annual questionnaire to his people. And one of the questions was, do you think there should be a lot more foreign aid, just foreign aid, or a little less foreign aid? And they all came back with red lines through them. Are you kidding? No foreign aid is what people were saying. I don't know that that's changed in the American psyche.
Well, this fighting this virus is in our own self-interest, because as it continues to spread and multiply and change, mm-hmm. a variant could arise that can come back and bite us. Mm-hmm. We should note that so this agreement is to give 500 million doses. The World Health Organization has estimated 11 billion doses are needed to fully vaccinate the world. So it's not a drop in the bucket, but it's not everything. I mean, there's far more that our country can and should be doing to help countries help themselves to produce the vaccine, to distribute it. It is wild that in this country, we're all sitting here, we're all vaccinated, and we are begging our fellow citizens to get arrested. We're giving away beer, we're giving lottery tickets, shopping cards. You know, please, please get the vaccine. We have plenty of it here, and there are places in the world where they have none, and they're desperate for it. And we need to. I feel a little guilty about it, but I think we need to do more.
Mm. Well, I think you're raising a good point. One of the things that we can do as a country, I think, to just help demonstrate how committed we are to being a functioning democracy is to do even a better job of getting everyone vaccinated. I mean, to be able to show that we are a country that takes it seriously and that we have gotten 70-80% of our population vaccinated, that would be a great symbol to the world. And I think we could be a role model that way, but we're not quite there yet.
Well, and Malia, do you see any signs of that moving tremendously in just in this country, of those numbers rising, of the efforts that are currently in place working, or do you think we're sort of where we're going to be? I mean,
I think the numbers will continue to increase just more slowly. The Biden administration is continuing to roll out new initiatives. Just last week, they announced a COVID vaccination challenge for colleges and universities that BARD has signed up for, and, you know, lays out a very clear initiative about, you know, how colleges and universities can help their populations get vaccinated. And so I think they're trying to be very thoughtful about different populations and how they reach out to them. And there will continue to be pockets around the country that need more specific attention. And I think as we're moving into the next phase of vaccination, it's really helpful that, like I see around here, you know, vaccinations now available at Stewart's, or they're going to various community centers that are frequented by, you know, different populations. And so that's going to be really important. And the Biden plan for colleges and universities emphasizes the role of what they call vaccine champions or ambassadors. And so identifying those people within each community who can really help lead that community towards vaccination is a really important next step.
Malia, have you talked to anybody who either refuses or hasn't taken the vaccine? And what are they telling you?
Well, I'm glad to say that I haven't really run into that in our community here at Bard. We're gathering the information and tallying the percentage points, but I have reason to believe we have an extraordinarily high rate of vaccination here on campus. So I'm not personally hearing from people around here who don't want to get vaccinated. There have been a couple folks who said, well, it's still under emergency use authorization.
Yep.
And so, what does that mean? Some concerns about that. But by and large, our community is very, very supportive of this.
How about you, Judy?
Oh, yeah. I've heard. Sorry. Oh, yeah.
A little geographical difference there, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. And a lot of times what you're hearing is they don't trust the science. It was rushed. You hear this. I hear it way too often. And then, you don't, as you approach this, you're trying to get them to get vaccinated and you want to persuade them, but you don't want to argue with them. And at some point, you just have to give up and walk away. I see that the numbers are in the 40% have been vaccinated down in the South. And there was a wonderful graphic that showed states that tended to vote for Joe Biden for president tend to be far more, have a far greater percentage of vaccination
Absolutely.
Than those that voted for Trump. It's along, political lines.
It is along political lines, but also within counties. I mean, New York is a very blue state, but if you look in the rural counties that Judy and I live in, for example, the numbers are not as high.
And it would be interesting to see the correlation between pro-gun and no vaccine.
Well, Judy, I don't know if you saw the same sign I did on the way in this morning, but there's, the new thing now, the new sign that seems to be littering people's lawns is unmask our children. And so that's one where you see the lawn signs are all over. For reasons I don't really want to get into, I think that this Albany idea of letting you out of a speeding ticket for getting, or not a speeding ticket, a parking ticket. If you get a parking ticket, you can get out of it if you show proof of immunization.
Well, I like the speeding ticket.
Not speeding, no.
So before that, Joe, I'm sorry, I missed the import of your position.
So what they're saying is that if you...
If, for example,
you parked in the front of the building as opposed to in the lot because, I don't know, whatever your reason is, like, I don't know, you were late, you didn't want to get shot, whatever the case is, you park in the front of the building and maybe you got a ticket prior to the announcement of this, then you can go and you can show them your Excelsior pass, and you get out of the ticket. I don't think that's a bad idea. That's all I was saying. We'll take a break. When we come back, you can come up with your ideas. Send them to us. panel@wamc.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this fine Thursday morning. It is the 10th of June, 10 minutes before the hour of 10 o'clock, and we welcome you to our conversation and thank you for being with us. Alan Chartok, Malia Dumont, Terry Gibson, and Judy Patrick make up the panel. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. We got this letter from Chris. Both we and the Russians are developing a new generation of ICBMs. Any chance of robust arm control talks?
Well, on the one hand, there certainly are very good chances of that discussion and maybe even agreement. Whether or not the Russians are capable of complying with what they've agreed to is another whole story. That's the problem with dictatorships. We do know that Putin is a liar, much like the man he got along with so well, Trump. So I'd rather see it than not. Believe me, I would. Make it harder for anybody to do anything. But, yeah, there is that.
Somebody had asked before, I think it was you, had asked, how do you judge success out of this meeting? And I think that's one of the places where you might be able to see some success and give it, you know, a real acknowledgement if we can come up with some type of deal that basically says, you know, we will not use nuclear weapons if you won't use nuclear weapons. I mean, Russia has a lot of weapons that are incredibly dangerous to both us and the world. And dealing with that issue, I think, has to be a top priority of the administration. I'm sure it is. And whatever they can do there to mitigate that is going to be part of their success.
Do you see any circumstance, Derry, in which the Russians would fire an ICBM in this world and in today's world?
Maybe not at us, but maybe at someone else. I suppose it is possible. You know, I think that it ties into what is Putin going to do to continue to maintain power? How does he continue to do that as time goes on? How does he continue to get the world to look at him and continue to be scared of him? And how does he continue to dominate the way he has? And I think those weapons are, they give him power.
Malia?
But neither side has signaled that arms control is going to be a major subject of conversation. So I'm sure it'll come up, but I doubt that anything truly substantial will result from this first summit between Biden and Putin. But perhaps they'll be able to release some kind of anodyne statement that you know, that arms control is an area of mutual interest for future conversation, something like that.
Malia, what do you make of Putin? There's a nice open-ended question for you.
Bad fashion sense. you could go a lot of directions with that question. I mean, he's an extraordinarily effective politician, certainly. Is there a particular thing you're trying to get at?
Or? Well, no. Well, what I've always believed is that this nothing he says means anything. That he's a you know, that he's a dictator. He may have put some lipstick on. You know, Putin may have put some lipstick on his performance. But the fact is, he's a guy who is a KGB colonel. You don't have to say any more than that. So it really does concern me that we're dealing with a guy who kills people and he kills his enemies.
Absolutely, he's a brutal dictator. But what's helpful is that he is not an irrational person. That's partly how he's been able to stay in power and be so effective at keeping power. So it's very possible to analyze him and his interests and what he's trying. And it's very, you know, understandable what he's doing from an analyst perspective. So it's not like trying to figure out someone who's completely volatile and nuts. You know, there's a rationale to what he does that can be analyzed and planned for. So that's helpful. And honestly, we probably should have predicted based on that. We probably should have predicted some of the things that Russia has been doing, like all, you know, the cyber attacks.
And all of this, Malia, comes the the whole issue of China. And China is pretty much on the table right now because both the Russians and the U.S. have concerns.
Yes. And the chair of the British Parliament's, whatever their Foreign Affairs Committee is called, has released a statement or an essay about that, that China is really the thing that's hanging over this week's summit with all the allies. All of our European out, they're concerned about Russian aggression. But Russia is not going to remake the world system the way China has the capability of affecting global trade patterns. The vaccine diplomacy from China is much more global than Russia. There's a much larger scope of Chinese efforts and impact and activities around the world. So certainly that is going to be, I think, a big topic of conversation on the sidelines of the summit.
So my total confusion where China is concerned is that on the one hand, we see them as dangerous in the South China Sea and the rest. But on the other hand, they're making half the stuff that, you know, the United States uses. How do we bridge that? I'm asking how easy questions. Yeah.
And I should say, I majored in Chinese language at Bard. I spent a couple of years living in China after graduation. And so I've retained a lot of connections and knowledge about the place. So I'm not just speculating based on, what I see in the news, but right. I have hopefully retained an understanding of some of the Chinese approach to things. So the fact that we have such deeply tied economies is obviously a huge opportunity in some ways, but as we've seen in other ways, like with supply chains, it's a huge vulnerability for the United States when we're not careful to keep certain critical technologies in our own country. It's incredibly important to retain as many different kinds of connections as possible with a country that we think may be our next big adversary, a cultural right. connection, educational connections. Like, that is what will keep the possibility of a peaceful rise of China alive. The more you try, I don't believe in, containment necessarily. If you're certainly you have to try to prevent aggressive behavior, but containment that extends to ending cultural contacts and educational contacts and economic ties just doesn't work. And so I think it's a good thing, even though there are a lot of complications associated with it, that we have such a strong economic link.
So just to come back at you one more quick time, so what would work?
What would work in terms of
containing the Chinese? Or obviously they're going to be as aggressive as they possibly can, and we've got to have a strategy.
I'm not sure. Yeah, I mean, they. I think focusing on relations with allies in the area has been important. And again, that's something that the Trump administration didn't really work on at all. There's been this long. For many years, we've been talking about a so-called pivot to Asia in the U.S. government and really focusing more of all of our efforts, not just military efforts, but diplomatic efforts, in recognizing that the Asia-Pacific theater is really going to be what determines, the future stability of the world going forward. It's going to be very important for us to have a strong military presence in the Western Pacific as something to reassure our allies and also deter China. And I think you're right. China will they've tested right up to the line of strategic ambiguity. How aggressive can they be in building new islands and really bullying Philippine fishing vessels and things like that.
We're so lucky to have you, Malia.
Yeah. Terry, I'll get to your point. We have some letters on this as well. When we come back, we'll pause there. Panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. We'll take a break. We have some messages and then news with Ray Graff. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Good morning. Welcome back to The Roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Malia Dumond, Judy Patrick, and Terry Gibson. Terry, you had thoughts on China right before we went to break. Do you remember what they are?
Well, it wasn't really about China, actually. It was going back to the Putin discussion, and I just thought it was important to throw into the discussion about Putin because Alan was asking, what do you think about Putin? I think we have to point out that the big news story there is that his opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, is now outlawed by the Russian courts. So when you're actually outlawing a outspoken critic of yours, it says a lot about the way that you govern. I just thought it was important to throw that into the mix.
Or when you're the president of the United States and you say the press is the enemy of the people, it's a pretty good example of that kind of thinking.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's see. President Trump just put out, he doesn't tweet anymore, but we get these statements that come in. Biden just said that he was told by the Joint Chiefs of Staff that climate change is our greatest threat. If that is the case and they actually said this, he ought to immediately fire the Joint Chiefs for being incompetent. I think of that as just a little palate cleanser. All right, let's go to other things in the other things on letters here. Greg says the best way to describe Russia isn't as a dictatorship. It's as if the mafia took over the United States and was run by the CIA. It's a nation run by criminal organizations and headed by an intelligence organization, and they have nukes. John says, I believe that we are soon reaching a point where most anyone who wants a vaccine can get one. Let experts determine the precise date, but we should shut the vax program down soon. Let those who are fervently against vaccines actually take responsibility for the risky behavior. No more masks, no more vaccines. Take your own risk. Yes, we should aim to get as many vaccinated as possible, but let's put an end date on it and switch focus on vaccinating the rest of the world.
Well, that's a fascinating point, isn't it?
Seems like a cruel game, but
should we let them die even though, because they're stupid? That's an issue. The answer for me is, maybe it's my confirmation as a liberal, is no, you can't let them die. You have to point out the error of their ways and get them to do this thing. And by the way, they offer a tremendous problem for the rest of the population by not getting vaccinated.
Let's go to this letter from Bob, who said, Alan said this morning that all you need to know about Putin is that he was a KGB colonel. The implication being having held that position means that he is a murderous thug.
That's right.
Alan, what would you make? What would that make George W. Bush, George H. Bush, who was head of the CIA, or do you think the CIA never engaged in action similar to the KGB?
I think it's absolute false equivalency. You know, it's one thing to say that the CIA operates around the world and they do their thing. But this guy is without any kind of ethical standards. I reject that. I really do. I'm sorry.
I mean, that gets to your point, too, earlier about Navalny, right? I mean,
yeah, I mean, I think I don't remember either of the Bushes outlawing any of their critics and putting them in jail. So I think,
poisoning them, perhaps,
or poisoning them, yeah, right?
or sticking them with a needle as they walk by. Yeah.
So I don't really think I can see that as being a fair comparison.
With a subject line that says European whiplash, Eric writes, the panel overlooks the damage done by George W. Bush administration in getting the West into the Iraq conflict. This was followed by the relief European allies experienced when Obama took over. Now that Biden has expunged Trump, can one blame them for the feeling that it's deja vu all over again?
Yeah, I think that we really should not ever forget what George W. Bush did to this country.
Absolutely right.
We really should not ever forgive him for that.
And yeah, you're right.
It should be part of his legacy. It is part of his legacy.
You shouldn't win by default, right? Like, win by comparison.
I think that's a good letter.
Although it is a good letter, although I have to say, Bush is looking better compared to what we had just
Well, right.
Through.
That's it. Yeah. On Afghanistan, as we were just talking about it, the U.S. is weighing the possibility of airstrikes if Afghan forces face crises. The Pentagon is considering whether to intervene with warplanes or drones in the event that Kabul is in danger of falling to the Taliban, though no decisions have been made. This from the New York Times. The Pentagon is considering seeking authorization to carry out airstrikes to support Afghan security forces if Kabul or another major city is in danger of falling to the Taliban, potentially including flexibility into President Biden's plan to end the U.S. military presence in the conflict. Mr. Biden and his top national security aides had previously suggested that once U.S. troops left Afghanistan, air support would end as well, with the exception of strikes aimed at terrorist groups that could harm American interests. But military officials are actively discussing how they might respond if the rapid withdrawal produces consequences with substantial national security implications. It is important to stress that no decisions have been made yet. But they added that one option under consideration would be to recommend that U.S. warplanes or armed drones intervene in an extraordinary crisis, such as a potential fall of Kabul.
What do you think, Malia?
Well, having spent a year in Kabul myself. First of all,
just remind us why you spent the year in Kabul.
Yes, I was deployed there as an intelligence officer with the Army And served in the theater headquarters in Kabul.
What was your rank?
At that point, I was a... This is a while ago. I was an O2, so I was a first lieutenant.
Okay. Huh. And how did what was your rank? What's your rank now, or what did you leave as?
O4. I'm a major.
Okay, cool. All right. With all that worked out, go ahead and answer your question.
To get back to the question. Having airstrikes and armed drones, we've been using those. This is not a new thing, just in case anyone is under the impression that the fact mm-hmm. that this is being considered is suddenly introducing some new element. No, we've had airstrikes and armed drones in Afghanistan for 20 years now, which is not to say that it's necessarily the right answer, but I just point that out for background. I think it's important to have some flexibility. Who knows what might happen when it might be useful to be able to stop some kind of overrunning of Kabul. Although that's not really the way the Taliban operates. They're not some big army that engages in huge sieges. And if Kabul is in danger of being toppled, I mean, one of the characteristics of Afghanistan, I mean, it's incredibly mountainous. It's very difficult to control territory there. And if Kabul's in danger of toppling, probably the rest of Afghanistan is already, under conflict with various warlords who have been, exercised their own influence over the past, well before the United States was active there. So saving the central government, saving Kabul doesn't necessarily mean that, Afghanistan is at peace or well governed. So it's overall not a great situation for the Afghan people, but trying to preserve some space for the government to, reconstitute itself and grow and strengthen, I think, is important.
But not to put words in your mouth, but just to ask, would you agree with the sentiment that it's good to keep your options open as far as it comes to airstrikes?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Anybody?
So let's get it straight.
Yeah.
If I'm in my naivete trying to figure this out, we had all these troops there. We're now withdrawing because it hasn't worked. We, as Malia just said, we've been using drones and we're using airstrikes all along anyway. So does this really mean much to say that, we're going to use these things after the troops have left when they haven't worked when they were there?
Well, it depends what your definition of success is. To a certain extent, what the troops are doing there did work. And there's been no other al-Qaeda attack launched on the United States from there. The presence of these troops did, prevent any other major attacks from occurring. Now, it haven't defeated the Taliban. The Taliban, as I said, is not some kind of traditional conventional military. You can't vanquish it on the battlefield. It requires an ongoing presence. So as long as we had troops there, we were able to sort of, keep that tamped down. Removing the troops is going to give them more freedom of maneuver. It works with presence, and when you remove it, it doesn't. So that's why I think having some flexibility with airstrikes as needed, although I hope we never have to use them, is important.
Well, as the old saying goes, are you sure? I mean, there is an argument to be made, correct me if I'm wrong, because you're so much closer to this and more knowledgeable, but that the Taliban understood that we were thinking about getting out, and the best way to get us out was to leave us alone and not attack us.
No, I think... everyone in Afghanistan has always known that the United States is not going to be there forever. I think even a lot of people in the United States are surprised by how long we've stayed there. It's a little bit of a strange logic what you're suggesting, that because they get what I saw when I was there is there's a lot of public relations victories that they would get by launching a rocket, at an American base. Even if the rocket doesn't hit anyone, doesn't damage anything, the fact that they were able to launch it and they made an announcement, we launched a rocket to the Americans, makes them, you know, made them look capable and strong. You know, we are defying the great power of the world by launching a rocket at it. And so their measures of success are much easier to reach than ours.
All right. Anybody else on the Afghan airstrike possibility?
Well, it does just sort of take me back to a lot of other instances where our country has gotten ourselves involved in foreign conflicts and stayed there for a long time and then had difficulty figuring out how to get out of it. And I know it's not the same, but part of this reminds me of how we saw the United States withdraw from Vietnam and wondering what was going to happen when we left. And I am wondering what's going to happen when we leave and what are the ramifications going to be for our country and for the world in general if things don't work out. And I wouldn't want to be Joe Biden right now having to make these decisions. This is something that he's inherited, and I think it's a really tough situation.
All right. Let's move on to some letters here that we have. This one from Carol. This may have already been covered, but I think offering lotto tickets or college education, et cetera, for vaccinated will end up backfiring. The next global pandemic will see tens of thousands or more holding back from getting vaccinated, waiting for the monetary reward. It is the responsible thing to get vaccinated because it's the right thing to do for the good of society. It is our civic duty to promote the health of all society. I understand the concern, but it seems to me that if you have the choice of being sick or a lottery ticket, you probably would get the vaccination. But
if you remember in the early days when the vaccine was available, the crush to try to find an appointment, I mean, that lasted a couple of months. Now we've got this tail end. You've got, you know, the reluctant, the people who aren't that worried about the vaccine. It is taking some incentives. And there have been some studies that say that maybe this incentive structure is not going to work very well. The best way to do it is to have your own personal doctor try to convince you to do it. But a lot of people don't go to their doctors anymore.
I got a better way. Making it mandatory.
Or I have a better way, getting rid of the emergency authorization and making it permanent. I think a lot of people are waiting for that.
Yep. Ken writes, the only problem with folks not getting vaccinated, just not getting vaccinated, is that they become a petri dish for potential mutant strains of the virus, of a mutant with a spike protein that works but is sufficiently different from the one used to generate the vaccine arises. We could find ourselves at square one again.
Could schmud, but I think you have to do what you have to do, right?
At least for now, yes. Susan says, it's hard for me to care what happens to people who refuse to be vaccinated. However, I do care about what their illnesses will do to our healthcare system. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Let's talk about the Keystone Pipeline. The Keystone XL pipeline developer has pulled the plug on the controversial project. The move comes just months after President Biden revoked a Trump-era approval. The firm behind the pipeline officially scrapped the project on Wednesday, months after President Biden revoked a cross-border permit for the controversial pipeline and more than a decade after political wrangling over its fate began. The pipeline, which would have stretched from Alberta's forests to the refineries along the U.S. Gulf Coast, became the center of a broader controversy over climate change, pipeline safety, eminent domain, and jobs. Those same concerns have spawned similar battles to stop pipelines in states including Montana, Minnesota, and Virginia, part of an effort to keep fossil fuels in the ground. The Keystone XL project also took on special significance because of the sea change in public and business attitudes toward climate change. The process of extracting oil from thick tar sands consumes enormous amounts of energy, a combination of strip mining and underground steam injection, and exacerbates the impact on the planet's atmosphere. TC Energy said in a statement that it decided, along with the government of Alberta, to end the multi-billion dollar pipeline. Anyone on that?
Well, I think, I'm sorry, go ahead, Terry.
It's a significant victory for those in the environmental activism community that have been fighting for this for a long time. And I'm sure that they're happy, and those of us who want to protect the environment should be happy as well. But I do think it's important to point out that the oil and gas industry is one of the most powerful industries in the world. And they did still manage to make an awful lot of money off of this pipeline for the portions of it that were built, because a lot of it has been built. And I think if what we're saying is that we have somehow defeated the oil and gas industry, I would stop short of kind of embracing that message, because I think that what they figured out was just another way to make money and decided that this wasn't it. And I think they're going to continue to be doing everything they can to continue to profit from the fossil fuels that are in the earth, and environmental activists can't let up. They still have a lot of work to do.
So do you think this is just, you know, we flex our muscles and we say, isn't this great? We won. But on the other hand, isn't this just an economic outcome because the U.S. is doing so well in terms of its own oil industry? And therefore, they took a look at the end game here and said, we're not going to win on this.
Well, I mean, the way I read the story is that the oil and gas industry has kind of reached the conclusion that they already have won to some degree. They've made an awful lot of money off of this pipeline as it is, and I think they've just decided they can't get more out of it, and they've just decided to walk away because the pressure against them, it has been intense. And the United States government, and specifically Joe Biden, has said that he's not going to allow this to happen, and so that really is the end of the deal. And I'm personally glad to see we have a president that's taking environmental conservation seriously.
Right, this pipeline wasn't going to create a lot of jobs. It was going to create some construction jobs, but again, a lot of the pipeline's already been built, so those jobs have come and gone. I think the company itself was going to employ 50 people permanent, but that's what you get from the far right or supporters of the pipeline saying, well, this is going to cost Americans jobs. Well, it's not going to cost Americans jobs.
Anybody else? Malia?
Yeah, so the biggest investments that were made into this effort came from Canada, the government of Alberta, and the company, which is a Canadian company. And so I really hope that the Biden administration takes the opportunity with their infrastructure plan, which focuses so much on clean energy, to expand that to the diplomatic realm and really find ways to work with Canada on clean energy projects. Just like there could have been a cross-border pipeline, thank goodness the Keystone Pipeline is not going to happen, there can be cross-border clean energy projects. So I hope that this this whole conversation can be pivoted in that direction, because I think there are a lot of opportunities there.
Let's see. We just have about 2 minutes here before we go over to a break. We have some letters on Afghanistan. Gary says, I appreciate the balanced analysis today about Afghanistan. Our mission changed from capturing the 9/11 plotters to somehow reforming the country. Invasion by a foreign army to do that is, excuse me, is an absurdity. My apologies.
For what? It's a natural thing.
It's an absurdity. The American exception.
A few months ago, that would have really freaked us out.
I know, exactly. That's why we were all alone there. The American exceptionality is that we never accepted for ourselves, but apply it to other places. Did that make sense, or did the sneeze screw that up? Was the message lost there? No?
I think the sneeze blurted a little bit.
Susan writes, haven't we had enough of bombing drones, troops, etc.? We need to withdraw and stay withdrawn. Enough with solving every problem with war. The military complex is thrilled with our endless wars. Let's stop making them so happy. Malia, any thoughts on that?
Well, I think I can speak on behalf of my fellow soldiers when I say that we would be very happy if wars did not exist, because people don't join the military because they want to go to war. I agree with Eisenhower's warning against the military-industrial complex, and there are economic interests in the private sector about that. But I think it's a little bit simplistic to suggest that people are were made happy by, by engaging in this kind of.
All right, we're going to pause there. When we come back, we'll have our last go around. We have a couple more topics to discuss. And last time, our final moments with our great panel, Alan Chartok, Malia Dumont, Terry Gibson, and Judy Patrick. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll continue right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. Alan Chartok, Malia Dumont, Terry Gibson, and Judy Patrick. We love having you with us. And we'll be with you for another 15 minutes or so in the panel form. And we welcome your letters. So last call on those and last call on subjects for our wonderful panelists. We get this letter from John. Am I in the minority of Americans who expected our continued presence in Afghanistan to be ongoing, much like our presence in Okinawa or Guam? I thought surely we would be there for the long term to watch Russia, Iran, and other nations. Malia, I'm going to throw that to you.
That's an interesting point. The ongoing presence we have in places like Guam, it serves a very different purpose. Obviously, Guam didn't need to be pacified. It's a place that we were able to base ourselves there for forward projection purposes throughout the Pacific. So, as far as I understand, the Guamian government is doing very well and is happy to have us there. I'd be surprised if we don't continue to have some sort of advisory capacity in Afghanistan for a while, but it's a completely different kind of mission and situation. And it would require such an enormous presence going forward if we were going to try to just keep on tamping down the Taliban and activity. Mm-hmm. It just would require completely different presence.
Just for the record, I like the word Guamian.
Yeah, me too.
I like that. I didn't know that was the way you said it. That's cool. I like that. We go to this letter from Ed, who says, if you want China to be on a level playing field, get rid of the developing nation treaty. If the Chinese had to pay for shipping, it would make their goods be priced in a more equitable way. Anyone on that? All right. Hearing none, we go on to what may be our final story for this morning in our last few minutes. The report came out yesterday, the inspector general, that the Park Police did not clear Lafayette Square protesters for the Trump visit. When the U.S. Park Police led law enforcement officers into a crowd of mostly peaceful protesters outside of Lafayette Square on June 1st, 2020, including officers equipped with chemical irritants and officers on horseback, they did so as part of a plan made days earlier to build a fence around the park to protect officers, not to facilitate the visit minutes later by President Donald Trump. That apparently just a coincidence. He went to a nearby church. This all came out of an inspector general's report that was released yesterday. The report also found that D.C. police officers fired tear gas at protesters as they moved away from the park toward 17th Street. The park police did not deploy tear gas on June 1st, but did on previous days. And Bureau of Prisons officers fired pepper spray munitions from the park without provocation during the clearing. Investigators also found that the audio warnings inside by the park police before the operation were not widely heard by the crowd and mostly ineffective. The report by the Interior Department's Inspector General focuses on the park police and does not fully address questions about the involvement of other agencies or the Trump administration. Although for the president's part, he announced yesterday that he was fully exonerated.
Sounds like Bushu to me, I'll tell you right now.
Bushu, I like Bushu. That.
It's a word that takes the place of another word.
Yeah. So I'm going to use it.
It's very Guamian.
Yeah, I'm very Guamian. So, there's just too many things wrong with that. And I really have to suspect whoever this inspector general's report came from. We do know that there was so much stuff that was going on. It was just too convenient that he was walking across the park. They were belting them with these, all of these various semi-weapons. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And I think what we need is an inspector general of the inspector general.
Well, the whole thing is on video. I mean, we saw exactly what happened. And regardless of what the report says, there's no way that is going to change the minds of those who actually saw what happened.
To your point, I remember watching it unfold that day, and you see everyone in the square. Then you see Bill Barr come out. You see different members of the administration walk out. And then it happens. It just doesn't seem...
That's what I think happened. I mean, I think the report even kind of indicates that there was some kind of plan in place, and the people who were in charge of executing that plan were doing their best to do that. And then at the last minute, the Trump administration and his minions basically inserted themselves into the plan, uninvited, and took use of that and made it their photo op. And I think it just became chaos that no one really could control.
Sounds like Buju to me.
And it's Buju.
Well, what happened that day was atrocious, but I think Terry makes some good points, because initially, and I will fault the media on this one, because it was portrayed in the media as we were watching it that this happened just because Trump wanted to walk over to that church with a Bible. When you read the report, they had planned to clear the park to put up the fence. Now, they did it wrong. They could have waited for the curfew to set in. They sprayed people with tear gas when they said they didn't. It was a total disruption of freedom of speech, and it shouldn't have been done. But to say that it was done explicitly so he could walk over there with his Bible, I think that was a narrative that we grasped onto too soon without question.
So I don't agree with that. I think that's
Let's see.
Buju.
These kind of inspector general reports are designed to answer very narrow, very specific questions, and they leave a lot of other questions unanswered. So what most disturbs me about this is, so they're saying, and it could be true that in this very specific and narrow question, the park police did not do this specifically for President Trump. So they were going to do it anyway? Like that? So that to me is crazy. Why?
We didn't rob the bank then. We were going to do it later.
And it wasn't only park police, right? It was a whole bunch of other ragtail groups that were brought into this thing by the president's people, because they couldn't use law enforcement and they couldn't use the other available things like the army.
Yeah, the Bureau of Prisons was involved.
Well, and I think that point's really interesting, Malia, that, I mean, this doesn't exactly exonerate anybody. They were going to do it anyway.
Right. So they're saying even if President Trump, even if none of these people had come out of the White House, they were going to fire tear gas at peaceful protesters?
Yeah.
That's their defense?
Come on.
Not the best.
And I should say, you know, even though we did all see it happen, and I said before that we saw what happened, so we're going to believe it, I guess that's not exactly true, because we now have a whole faction of the country that saw the insurrection happen in the Capitol.
And said it didn't happen.
So sometimes
it's in the eyes of the beholder. Our eyes can deceive us, yes. Yeah. It's very weird. All right. Were you going to say anything? Oh, no, I think.
No.
Okay. All right. That's fine. You're a lot.
Just one other.
Yes, please.
Alan mentioned, all these other agencies involved. And I think, D.C., because it's such a strange mix of city government, federal government, all these different agencies, plus, I don't think we'll ever have full clarity on, to what degree the president actually tried to influence or involve certain people. But even if he didn't, These agencies, it's very, very complicated the way they work together. And so I don't think it would have been smooth or well run without a lot more coordination and training in advance.
Well, they clearly, I mean, like as she says, we'll never really know. But they, to me, it seems clear that they saw an opportunity to take credit for something and to give Donald Trump a very unique photo op, and they just jumped on it and did it. And it was a very last minute, and it all came together, and it looked very last minute.
And if they needed to clear the park to put up a fence to further protect the White House, they could have done it at 2 o'clock in the morning where there's hardly anybody out and about. Mm.
Yeah, and then there's a certain amount of something that's going on here. You know, we all know that Trump says he's going to run for president another time. And they're trying to clear up a lot of the things that are hanging around Trump's neck. And this is one of them. So this may be a little, what Cuomo used to call Papa Cuomo, post hoc, propter hoc. Slowly but surely, each of these things that we knew Trump had done are being sort of, quote, cleared up. And it's very, very suspicious.
We have this letter from Dan, who writes, "We should not have a foreign policy that changes every 4 to 8 years. Take foreign policy out of the executive branch hands, get Congress to do it. Economics 101. I mean, wouldn't that be changing it every 2 years?
Not only.
I was just going to say that exactly.
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
That's better. But anyway, what happens if we all change party? Republican elected representatives would, should reflect majority's rule. Let's all become Republicans, but not Trump-like Republicans.
Well, I mean, first of all, right now we're living in a country where the majority isn't always ruling. Oftentimes the minority is ruling, which is what's happening in the United States Senate right now. So if you want foreign policy by minority rule, which is what you might very well get, I personally don't want that.
So. But I get the frustration behind the letter, even though you and I agree on what the problems, the logic problems are.
Yeah. Let's talk about prices jumped 5% in May, largest increase since the Great Recession. The most recent crop of inflation figures are unlikely to rattle the Biden administration or the Federal Reserve. There is a 5% increase in May. That is the largest increase since that recession. Policymakers say it's temporary. I'm looking at the stock market. It was at 85 points, I believe, right now. So
I don't know. When Roselle and I bought our first house in the Berkshires many, 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 many years ago, the interest rate was 13%. that was a lot of money. And we paid it off as quickly as we possibly could. And the bank wasn't very nice about the whole thing. They weren't giving them out. You know, I do think we're in for some inflation problems here. And those are going to be based on the fact that there's been so little happening while the country's been locked down. We'll see what happens. But to me, we'll have some inflation. The question is, does it stay with us?
Mm. Good point.
Well, the world has been locked down. I mean, I think we just really are just now coming to terms with the fact that the world really has just gone through an incredibly traumatic experience. We have been locked down. It is certainly going to have an impact on the economy and all aspects of our lives. And nobody really knows what the other side of this is going to look like yet. But it's going to be different.
Don't you think, though, that with the world being locked down, as you say, that we've done relatively well? I mean, you know, when you think about what could have happened, we got through it.
Yeah, the economy is coming back. I went to a yard sale a couple of weeks ago, and I saw a piece of plywood on sale for $8,765.
What?
Just a joke. It was a joke, you know, a yard sale joke. It was pretty funny.
That is
though.
Funny. That is funny.
Let's see. We go to Malia, anything you wanted to say about the inflation?
Just that I'm glad that I don't have a 13%.
All right.
I go back to what I've said all along. Coke is now $2.
Yeah.
Or more.
$2.40.
In one place.
Yes.
In my little place in the morning this morning. Yeesh. I saw $1.99.
Yeah, that's a cheap place to go. All right. One last letter because I have 20 seconds. I don't want to use that. Let me get this straight. The police had days to prep for their action in Lafayette Square, and this violent assault on Liberty was the best outcome they could come up with. Atrocious and very hard to believe, says Oliver.
Oliver's right.
We'll give Oliver the last word. My thanks to everyone. Alan, thank you so much. Malia, man, you're amazing.
You
thank you
terrific.
So much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. With all
really glad to join you. Thank you.
Important information you shared. Same to both of you, Judy and Terry. Thank you very much. We'll be back with a Congressional Corner right after this.